Welcome to System Mastery, the podcast where we behead a dishonorable samurai three keep two dice at a time. I'm Jeff, joined as always by my co-host John, and this week's guest host, Brian. And we're discussing an early edition of the 1996 John Wick-penned samurai slasher, Legend of the Five Rings. Fair warning, everyone here sort of liked this game, so this one may be low on disrespectful vitriol. Welcome back. John, how you doing today?
Doing good. Doing real good.
We've got our traditional rum and cokes and a single floating raw cranberry in them.
Oh yeah, that makes it festive.
That's holiday. Yeah. And we've got our guest host today, Brian. How you doing?
Hey.
Brian's an old friend from way back. He has a rich trove of interesting games for us to dive into and review, so...
Yeah, I stole Legend of the Five Rings from him.
All right, Legend of the Five Rings is the game of the week, and it is...
It's the game of the wick! Ha ha! John Wick, yeah!
John Wick. We're going to talk about him later.
You're fired.
Legend of the Five Rings is a... it's basically set in a Japan that's the size of China and has some monsters nearby.
It is your standard fantasy Europe game, which is just like, it's all European countries. This is basically like, we just have fantasy Asia, and it's kind of basically Japan, but also anything else you want.
Absolutely. It's a game that tries to play off the kind of Edo period of Japan's set of rules for samurai and lesser people, and everyone lives around the emperor, and everyone follows a really strict and rigorous chain of command.
Yeah.
And so that means that the game actually has two character classes, which is interesting. You can play as a samurai... Or as a shugenja, which is a spell samurai.
Well, you're actually a bushi and a shugenja. Everyone's a samurai.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. I forgot. Yeah, you're either a bushi or a shugenja.
How dare you besmirch glorious Nippon?
Do I have to kill myself already?
Do it.
Okay. This game uses a really unique system for dice management. And I've read through it once, but the other guys here have actually played the game. So I'm going to ask... I'm going to say Brian to explain the basics of the dice math for this game and how it works.
Sure. So, it's a D10-based game, but, you know, those of you who might be familiar with other D10-based games, especially World of Darkness, this is a little bit different. We're not dealing on a success system. Instead, it's really it's your standard difficulty or target number. So, you get to roll a certain number of dice, you add them up. If you meet the target number, your action is successful. That's the basics. Where it gets interesting is in a few of the other levers that they have here to play with the math. The basic mechanics here are that the number of dice you roll and the number of dice you count are not the same. The nomenclature is basically XKY. So if you're doing an action, you might roll six dice, but you get to keep, let's say, three. So you'd roll six dice, see, you know, what they come up with, and then pick out the three best ones, add them up. If you make your target number, you succeed. There are a number of ways that you can play with this, but right off the bat, it adds an interesting element when you're dealing with characters and character growth. So, you know, obviously adding more dice increases your chances of rolling high results on any given die. You get to add up higher numbers. But at some point, you're going to hit a ceiling there, and you're really not going to start raising the ceiling on, you know, the difficulty of tasks you can do or the level of your successes, unless you can start adding dice that you keep. And that's generally a lot harder. So right there, you know, it's got a neat twist on it, and that gets more interesting when you start taking into account the raise mechanic.
Yeah, and the whole system feels very... I mean, even just character creation is also very... reminiscent of, say, World of Darkness or anything like that. You've got sort of the standard stats, and you've got the 1-5, which is one of the big things.
Right.
But in this game, you also have meta stats outside of your standard statistics.
Now, when you say it's got the 1 to 5, you mean those are kind of the generic statistics, say the White Wolf style of statistics?
Yeah, your stats and abilities, your attributes abilities, will go from 1 to 5.
Okay.
So, you know, 1 being you're kind of crappy at this, and 5 being you're awesome.
And I'm assuming that even though there's a 1 to 5 system, samurai are expected to have a bare minimum of something in each one of their...
Well, everybody starts with 2. You're expected to be competent, and 2 is basically the human average.
Yeah, if you're a samurai, you're generally not going to be bad at anything, as far as stat-wise goes.
Yeah, and they expect certain skills from you as well. I'm sorry, though, you were talking about metastats, please.
Well, yeah, so you'll have your generic stuff. You've got your agility, your intelligence, your strength, your stamina. You know, the stats that you're all used to. But each one of them are divided into 5 rings.
Mm-hmm. The legend of
these 5 rings. And so you've got 2 stats that aren't tied together, so you might have, say, intelligence and agility.
That's fire, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
So
again, these rings are basically the traditional Western elements, and then they added void.
Yeah.
Well, it's really the core or the thematic baseline for the setting. It really takes as its sort of background 2 core texts. One of them is Sun Tzu's Art of War, which many of the listeners will be familiar with, and the other one is Miyamoto Musashi's text, A Book of 5 Rings. And in The Book of 5 Rings, he pretty much covers a very broad Eastern-style philosophy that takes the 4 Western-style elements and then adds the 5th. And the 5th one is Void. So
Void being kind of a combination... In the game, whenever you have to make a roll for a specific effect, the game will ask you to make a fire check or an earth roll or something like that. Like, for example, to lift something might be an earth check. Void is generally considered to be using all of the other elements at the same time.
Well, that and also the possibility of sort of stillness.
Yes.
The idea of emptying oneself of outside distractions.
Meditation, for example.
Yeah, meditation.
Yeah.
So that kind of gives
you
a
basic idea.
It
also ties into the magic in the system. It's
yes.
Very heavily into the void.
Now
the metastats themselves, you'll have a rating in them just like you have a rating in your normal stats. But they are limited to... They will be as high as your lowest rating in that. So let's say intelligence agility is in fire. Even if you've got a 5 intelligence, you are real smart. If you've got a 2 agility, you've got a 2 in your fire. Because it's only as good as your weakest point in that ring.
Right, so that generally encourages players to play average and not try... If you want to have a 5 in a stat, you really have to, because you're going to need to invest the equivalent of 10 points in it. You're going to need to get both of those numbers up. I was going to say, the only other thing I remember from Void specifically is that it's used as the measurement for tea ceremony capability.
Well, it actually does.
Yeah.
It does do that.
There's a lot of other stuff, too, but that was the one that stuck out for me.
There are 2 real things that every character cares about when you're talking Void. This goes back to something that I had mentioned a few minutes ago, which is the raise system. The raise system is basically, you might think of it in another game, it might be called Shots. But it's generally not as broad or robust as it is in Legend of the Five Rings. The basic idea of a raise system is that if you want to take an action, you say, I want to, you know, cast a spell, or make an attack roll, or ride a horse, or do whatever, and it's fairly challenging. You'll say to the storyteller, I want to do this, and he'll quote you a target number. This is the difficulty. At that point, most games will just say, roll your dice and see if you succeed. In L5R, you've got another step, which is the player can say, I want to raise. Raising lets you voluntarily increase the difficulty of the task in increments of 5, so you make it harder on yourself. But if you succeed, it increases the margin of success.
So you make it more awesome.
Yeah, you don't just do it passably. You do it amazingly. So if you attack, you can raise multiple times to increase damage. You can, you know, do it particularly stylishly.
Mm-hmm.
You can also, if you're playing in a way or you, you know, describe the scene in a way that everyone really appreciates at the table, the storyteller can award you free raises, which are basically the benefit of a raise without paying the target number cost.
A stunt mechanic.
Yeah.
Essentially, before stunting was really, you know, a thing, that's what they were doing here. Now, the Void ring comes in here because you can't raise more times than your Void rating.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so if you've got a void rating and, you know, you start out at 2, and you just leave it there, you're never going to be able to be super impressive to people. Like, you can raise a couple times, and that's great, but if a guy's got, like, a void of 4, and he has some skill or whatever that he's amazing at, and he raises 4 times, someone's gonna look at him doing that and going, holy shit, that guy is insane. How is he able to do that? And so your void lets you play with the system a little more and use void points to try and get more successes, keep more dice.
Right, and this is the other selling point of void, is that you have a number of void points to spend in a game or a story equal to your void rating. And spending a void point lets you add a die that you not only roll, but you also keep. So it lets you shift the math curve again. So if you've got a high void, it's a kind of meta stat. You'd be as good as anybody else most of the time, but when you really want to turn it up, yours goes to 11.
Yeah.
All right.
So the other interesting thing with this is just, I mean, still staying stat-wise, starting characters don't get to be amazing. Starting characters are capped at 4. You do not get to a 5. As a starting guy, they do not want you to go, oh yeah, I am the smartest dude in the world, or I am the most agile man ever. No, man, you're a starting character. Build up to it. Build a reputation.
And that's
become Hercules. Don't just start as Hercules.
That's a standard issue with point buy based games. You know, with Exalted, for example, or with White Wolf, it's really easy to take point buy to its logical extreme and go, all right, well, if all it does is cost me points to get to Celerity 5, then fuck, I'm going to Celerity 5. I don't care.
Especially in a scaling cost game where you can start with flat cost.
Mm-hmm.
It's always, mathematically speaking, going to be cheaper in the long run to just start really good at something and then branch out from
there. Well, this game solves the whole problem by just doing a hard cap. It says if you're a starting character, you can't get above this X value of stats. So your character's a samurai. He is maybe a samurai of some note, but he is not the big guy. He's not Miyamoto Musashi, the one samurai in the world anyone's ever heard of.
And you've got that cap on not just abilities, or not just attributes, you've also got it on abilities.
Mm-hmm.
So not only are you not the strongest dude ever, you're not the best swordsman ever.
One of the things I'd like to talk about here is that there's a whole set of abilities in this book that are considered low abilities, and characters shouldn't have them. I mean, you can have them, but damn, no one should see you doing them.
Well, yeah, people make fun of you if you're doing that, because they're like, that's below your station. If someone sees you gambling and you're supposed to be a noble samurai, they're like, what are you fucking doing?
Well, it doesn't just go in that. Some really useful skills, like stealth, is considered a low skill.
Yeah, no hiding if you're a samurai. God, coward.
You shouldn't be, if you're doing that, and you're seen doing that by people who are, you know, people, not Eta, they're like, wait, but you're a samurai. You're one of the aristocracy. Why are you skulking around
you
like a common
thief? You would
only do
that if you were doing something wrong.
So... Mm-hmm. You know, they don't even have to wait to find out there's proof that you were up to no good. Just the fact that you were using that skill, that you know how to sneak around, is evidence that you're not a respectable individual.
And there's also a sort of another couple meta stats. You've got glory, and you can earn glory, and glory is not only how, like, people see you and your glory in the Empire, but also what's expected of you as well. If you're high glory, people expect you to be a paragon of being a samurai in the Empire. If you're low glory, people assume you're low glory because you're some schmuck, and if you act like a schmuck, people are like, well, yeah, of course, he's some schmuck.
Yeah. Well, once you've made a name for yourself, they expect you to live up to that name. They expect you to continue doing great things, to represent your house, to make waves. If you're some schmuck, they don't really have expectations.
Yeah, if your glory rating is 1, everyone's like, whatever, that guy's some jag-off.
So let's just get through the basics of what makes a character in this game. You've got your 5 rings, which each include 2 stats. You've got your choice of being either a bushi, a samurai, or a shugenja, which basically means a fighter guy or a
spellcasting
guy. Then you have some abilities you get to pick. Then you have your substats that come through. And then you also have to choose your family, your clan faction. Now, this game, this is one of the things that made it hardest for me to read this game, is because how silly it kind of seems when they write the metafiction in here.
Yeah.
Clans are basically all animal-affiliated. So you've got scorpions and crabs and cranes and lions and...
Unicorns
and so on. And all of the metafiction in here is all these characters just kind of describing broad stereotypes associated with these clans. They're like, well, lion will always beat unicorn because unicorn falls for crane's scorpion treachery. And it's like, well, okay, I understand that you want to sound like folklore, but you sound too much like folklore. But on the other hand, in the actual play, I don't think this would come up as much. I don't think it'd be as big of a deal.
Well, really, more than deciding to be a Bushi or Shugenja,
you choose
the clan,
is
really your class.
Yeah, the clan is because each one of them represents a different aspect of samurai life. So, for example, a unicorn
is a rider.
A unicorn is a rider, and also is someone who has encountered people from horrible Western society.
Yeah, you've got more experience with outsiders, and they're generally known for being wealthy and for having horses.
Right.
That's one of the big things, is they have horses, and that's amazing.
And cranes are known for iaijutsu, which is the art of drawing a katana at the same moment that you strike with it.
Well,
so
it's
basically
a formalized dueling.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're particularly graceful, they're particularly fast. Dragons are known for fighting with both of their ceremonial swords at the same time. They have their katana and their wakizashi out, and they fight with it that way, the musashi style. So each clan has this kind of style to it that kind of defines what you are. The game says that it's okay to play a multi-clan game, to have a scorpion hanging out with a lion hanging out with a dragon, but then it strongly encourages you not to do that.
Yeah,
which makes sense.
Well, and it's weird because, I mean, most other games, when you look at something like, you know, you look at your D&D or whatnot, your standard class-based games, they really want you to not be all the same thing. If you have a game and it's, what is it, it's five rogues. Okay, well, this is fucking boring. And you don't have the ability to cover as much as you would want to. Here you can have, we've got five dudes that are from the Crab Clan. All right. You're all gonna have...
That might actually be a stronger story than
Absolutely.
Trying to do a mixed clan game. In
you're
fact,
gonna have
a lot
ties
to
each other, to each other's families. You're gonna want the best for your other
each
people.
Each other, yeah, absolutely. One
or
of the
some
big
crab
about...
guy who's like, I'm with a scorpion, goes, I don't trust that guy.
Oh, that's
and fuck
the worst.
That guy.
Oh, I hate that. Okay, scorpions are in this game. Scorpions are basically the trickster class who has dirt on everybody. And it's so annoying. I know that Brian's going to tell me that they're awesome. And that's fine. But it's so annoying to have a class that everyone hates but trusts anyway, because that's kind of the... You know, in Dungeons & Dragons, whenever they put in, like, a gypsy or something, when they put those in the game and they say, like, okay, gypsies, these guys steal things from people. Let them in your party. And everyone goes, no. That's what scorpions are. Scorpions have enough dirt on everyone that they can force everyone to put up with them, even though they're thieving, lying douchebags. That's... now, go ahead, correct me.
Actually, the first thing I'm going to say is, that is a totally valid complaint. But to sort of add to this, it's the thing about clan and faction in L5R really is that it's deeply embedded into the structure of the setting. It's not just that every faction or every clan has its own characteristics. It's that every one of them is supposed to have a function in the empire as a whole. So the Crane aren't just known for being great duelists and... you know, graceful and, you know, polite and influential, mm-hmm. they also serve the function of running the political arena and the economy of the empire. The dragon family are like keepers of secrets. The
yeah, they're mystery dudes in the mountains.
The scorpions are the secret police.
Yeah.
Everybody hates the NSA, but you need them.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, no, it's totally realistic to say, having a scorpion in the party, nobody else trusts him. Hell, other scorpions probably don't trust each other. But there's that tension is actually intended, and it can be difficult to get past, but it can add to the game. It's possible, although it takes a lot of creativity, to have a game where you've got people from different factions, and they look at each other and go, we're willing to see past the clan differences to work towards some shared goal.
Yeah.
The hard part is finding that shared goal, and it's usually a lot easier
to play one
start
clan.
Yeah, with characters from one clan. And each clan is deep enough in terms of its capabilities and its goals and agendas to support a full group themselves.
Each clan has at least three families.
Yeah, I was going to say, each clan has three families you can be from, and each family gives you a different bonus, and then So depending on what clan you are, then what family you are, and then if you are a Bushi or a Shugenja, you'll get these different bonuses.
Right, and,
that... you can take it super focused. Like, if you want to be a Crab Clan guy from the family that's all about being strong, you can just start without putting any points at a 4 strength right off the bat. And it really helps... It gives you some extra bonuses depending on what you want to be, and makes your character the flavor of whatever you wanted it to be without having to spend all your points on it.
It strongly emphasizes that those stereotypes do have some basis in fact. They're not absolute, but there's a reason why everybody thinks crabs are big and dumb and brutish and don't know their way around court. Because frankly, most of them don't.
But you can play against type. Because the crab family and the crab clan, they don't need to be in court. No, they're expected not to, so the fact that they don't know about court makes sense.
And the reason the crabs don't know about court is a great way to segue into talking about what the enemies in this game are. The crabs are the defenders of the wall, if you're familiar with that whole storyline. In this case,
Game of Thrones, but instead of White Walkers, it's Japanese demons.
Onis and stuff, yeah. So they defend the portal or the gateways and the borderlands to the Shadowlands, which is where every Japanese demon you've ever heard of lives.
Yep.
So there's all Oni and anything that looks like it's got a mask on, but that's actually its gross face. That's what's there.
You know, if the top of his head is cut off and there's water in there and a cucumber, they're probably going to beat it up.
If it's half a guy, then yeah, that's in there. That's the Shadowlands. And the crab family is expected to defend the borders of the Shadowlands, so they keep people out. That's kind of your bad guy MacGuffin in this game, is the Shadowlands. Otherwise, it's all inter-family intrigue. It's a bunch of stuff where... And again, I'm going to go back to the metafiction in this book. There's a lot of stuff where, like, there'll be a really cool war where a lion guy goads a crane guy into a big fight, and then randomly the lion guy just dies, and some person watching from the sidelines goes, "Ha! Scorpion trickery!" It's like, well, okay, if it's that obvious, then the scorpions fucking suck. If any time anyone dies randomly, it's a scorpion, you know that it's scorpions doing that. And so, again, that's just bad fiction. I think in gameplay, it would work amazingly.
Well, the whole point is, in gameplay, you'd be able to be like, okay, I do this thing, I engineer a situation, I'm playing a scorpion, I have some poison on a blade when it was supposed to be just a duel to wound, and he dies. And the problem is, if you get away with it, someone can go, "Scorpion treachery!
Yeah.
I would never do this!" But no one knows, someone can say that, and you go, fictions... maybe this crane put poison on his blade because he knew everyone would think it was a scorpion.
The fiction in the game is in the book is somewhat lacking, but that doesn't have anything to do with the gameplay, which I feel, I've never played this game, but I feel like the gameplay would be awesome. At the same time, not just a dump on scorpions, that storyline features a crane samurai goading a lion samurai into a personal duel. He's a way better duelist, and he just does it by going, "Well, you're probably a coward," and the lion samurai's like, "Well, fuck you then! Let's and it's like, well, okay, if that works every single time, then I feel like eventually the guy in charge of the lion family would be like, "Look, stop dueling crane dudes. It's a law. I'm putting it in place now. You're not allowed to do it because they trick you dumb fucks every time."
Well, it doesn't happen all the time. And I think in this case, you know, the fiction is designed really for players new to the setting.
It's teaching you how to play.
It's setting tone.
Yeah.
And it does a pretty good job of setting tone.
Also broad stereotypes.
Yeah.
A lot of broad stereotypes, which is all right. It's all
right. And you're right. In having actually played for quite a while, this game, it is actually a lot of fun. It works extremely well, which is not to say that it is, you know, perfect by any stretch.
There are definite
weaknesses in the game and the setting, and those do become apparent as you play it. But, you know, at least on a superficial level, or even, you know, really once you drill down a little bit, there's a lot here that's worth recommending.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this game... I think all three of us agree that we really enjoy this game and would look forward to playing it. Now, is this a first edition? Is there another edition of this out
there? This is a first edition. As far as I know, they're up to the third edition now, and that actually still is in print. But I hope, I'm not familiar with any of the later editions, I hope that they refined the mechanics in later editions, because this was a sound basis, but they definitely had some polish that they needed to get.
Absolutely. Now, we basically all agree. I mean, all we do here is dump on old role-playing games, so that's that's kind of the raison d'etre of this podcast. This game, absolutely fantastic. Nothing is perfect except four riffs. We all
yeah, I think we can all agree come together. Yeah,
no game is as good as riffs. All right, so once you get your clan and your kind of are you a spell guy or a sword guy selected, then you get to also pick benefits and disadvantages.
Now it's got the merits and flaws.
Merits
system.
And flaws, yeah.
So we all know Jeff hates merits and flaws.
I honestly feel like these are I always whenever I find a merits and flaws system in a book, I immediately pick through it to find the dumb ones. And this book has a lot less dumb ones than most.
Well, there's a lot fewer traps and a lot fewer obvious non-choices.
Right, ones where you have to take them.
Well, this is a flaw that gives me a point, but it doesn't do anything bad.
Well, one of the big problems you encounter, especially in White Wolf merit flaw systems, is merits that are flaws. Like, for example, since most of the White Wolf ones are done based on a scaling system, like you can take a Mentor of 1 or a Mentor of 5. If you take a Mentor of 1, it's some guy who doesn't really know how to teach you anything and he's useless. If you take a Mentor of 3, oh, hey, you made a guy. He can teach you some skills and he's useful. If you take a Mentor of 5, he's too busy for you. He doesn't even know who you are. He's not really your mentor.
He's way too important.
Why did you take 5 in this? Fuck you. This book doesn't really do that. The one thing I noticed in this book is that there's a I'll say there's a couple of weird ones. One of them is you can choose to not have an arm or a leg or a hand or a foot.
Yeah, you can be crippled.
Yeah, you can be crippled, and it costs you or you get less points for just missing an entire hand than you do from just taking a -1 to your dexterity stat, which is a little weird. But then again, that's the sort of thing I assume they have fixed in a future edition. And then there was the fun one with the scorpions, which one of the scorpion traits is you can have dirt on anyone with a there's a merit that says you have dirt on people. And scorpions get it for one less. And what that means is if you take it, even as a scorpion at all, you have dirt on everybody in the world that has a glory of 1 or lower. Everyone. Every single person in the world. You just go, oh, I got this merit, so I have glory on every single shitty person, shitty Ronin I encounter in every bar ever forever. Which, on the one hand, that's bad design because you shouldn't know everybody in the world. On the other hand, that's awesome.
Well, it's there basically to say, look, scorpions are good at this, and if you're a nobody, if you don't have the influence to protect yourself, and you meet a scorpion, you should really leave.
But the problem is they're like, oh yeah, I've got dirt on this dude, and he's glory one, and it doesn't matter if I have dirt on him, because who gives a fuck?
Yeah, you can still bully him around.
It also doesn't matter if he fucking kills you for having dirt on him, because... Yeah, you come up, nobody.
Exactly. You come up to him and you're like, I know your dirty secret. And he's like, stay.
Well, I'm going to kill you in this bar. Well, on the other hand, for 8 points, which isn't that much of an or 9 points, which isn't that much of an investment.
You can have dirt on the Emperor.
You can have dirt on the Emperor, which is hilarious because that's like having dirt on God. Like the most important person in the world, you'd be like, you know what? I know about the sheep, dude. I know. Of course, and again,
guards immediately show up.
And that comes back to the exalted thing where you can, the game has an option for you to buy something that will just get you killed. Why did you buy that?
Yeah.
It's fun that it's in there, but they could have streamlined it by just saying, hey, this caps at glory 6. You can't know anything about people who are better than you.
No, at that point, you pretty much just want to, you know, play the scene from The Dark Knight, you know. Congratulations, you figured out Bruce Wayne's dark secret, and you want to blackmail him?
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
I mean, honestly, if you build a character who has dirt on the Emperor, you should go ahead and build a retired character.
Yeah.
Because you can say, instead of having him killed by guards for the first time he tries to call on the Emperor, he could just say, hey, my character has dirt on the Emperor. Also, he's a local senator, and he lives in a big palace, and he doesn't need to go on adventures. The end.
Congratulations, you spent 8 points and won the game. Try again.
Good job, try again. So... Again, like I was saying, this game does have a merits and flaws system, and you know I dump on merits and flaws systems.
You do.
This one's all right. Most of them suck. This one's all right.
Now, I will say this. The one problem here, and it's not just a problem with L5R, it is a problem with merits and flaws systems, and that is anytime, merit or flaw, you have something left up to the GM's discretion.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of those in there. There's, like, fate...
Yeah.
Ones, yeah.
If you're unlucky and it, so that's one of them. You can be unlucky. Now the storyteller will at some point go, okay, you've got to re-roll that successful roll because you're unlucky.
Yeah.
Now this can be either, you know, oh, I try and do this riding maneuver. I succeed. Okay, re-roll it. That wasn't really too bad. Your GM's kind of lowballing, he's just not being a bitch.
You're unlucky, you fell out of the saddle, and it was true. In front of the girl you like.
Aww. Yeah.
But the problem being that this is one of those, it's a dare to the DM, is what this is. It's a dare to the DM to say, hey,
how much of a dick are you willing to be?
Yeah, Are you going to use this when it matters so that I actually paid these points for a reason? Well, then you're a huge dick, Jerry. Yeah,
what an asshole. Why would you make me do that? Ah,
it bothers me. Jerry has been my standard name for the DM whenever you call him out and make him a dick. But I believe Brian actually has an old RPG friend named Jerry. So if Jerry ever listens to this, don't worry. Jerry's just my generic name. I don't actually hate you. I don't know who you are.
I hate
you. I'm still in touch with Jerry. He might actually hear this.
I thought you were going to say, and he might actually be an asshole.
There's a solid chance he's a dick. Okay, so, but there's
I love you, bro. Let's get beer again sometime.
There's a couple of those type of issues in this game, which is, you take these things, another one is fated, where your character has a great fate, and yeah. it says, until such time as your fate has happened, you basically get an extra reroll to not die. But you don't know what your fate is, and your DM does, and he doesn't have to tell you, and he doesn't have to tell you when it happens. So you could say, for example, take fated, and then your DM's like, well, you're fated to visit a bar. Hey, you did!
Hey.
Your ability's gone. The end. And again, or actually for the first time, this game has a bit of a mean DM streak to it. We've talked about this a couple times.
Yeah, well, and it's not even like the system encourages DM as much as the system talks about.
Yeah, there's
being
a lot
a
of
dick.
I wanted to put this out there. This book contains the phrase double-edged sword more than any RPG book I've ever read, which is weird because katanas have one edge. But to get back to it, this book
that's why it's
book,
bad.
Yeah. This book has a lot of a particularly crafty DM will and so on, because it encourages the DM to play a little adversarial or through to a lot of adversarial, which is all right. You know, there's games that are built around that. I for a long time have said that a fourth edition D&D game that's run with a DM who just fucking hates you is still playable because the game's got such tight rule structure.
And that's because in something like that, or a very tactical game.
Yeah.
The rules aren't left up to the GM's discretion.
Yeah.
Isn't something where the guy who's in charge can just decide, this is when this happens, and this is how this happens. There are very strict mechanics. When you get into especially more storyteller-based games that are more about narrative, the GM gets more power to decide when and how things happen, which is great to tell a story, because now you can decide, okay, I can dictate the flow, I can make sure that certain elements of surprise can happen, or certain plot points go off when they should, but it also has the problem of, if your GM is a dick, he can just decide, no, fuck you, you don't get to do this, or something fucks with your character, or whatever.
Traditionally speaking, I'm not a huge fan of anything that gives too much DM discretion, and it's, you know, it's not because I hate DMs or I don't want them to be able to tell effective stories, it's because anytime they write DM discretion stuff into a book, they usually make that feel like it's the baseline. And of course, the most common example of this is the wish spell from old second edition D&D, where there's wish, and what's this do? Well, it can do these 7 or 8 different things. If your players try to use this spell, fuck them.
Yeah, it's, well, it has, like, mechanically, it can do these things, and it always works. Or your player can attempt to do something fun and creative. If your player is fun and creative, fuck with that player.
Don't let them have the thing they came up with that's fun and creative. Give them a person named Bill Ding instead of a building.
Yeah.
If they wish for gold, turn them to gold. If they wish for their enemy to be dead, warp them to the future to a point where their enemy died naturally. Hooray! This is super fun! Except it's not.
Yeah. And if you want all of the king's treasure, you appear in the king's treasury. Ah,
guards kill you. The end.
Yeah.
That's the kind of problem you encounter when you build adversarial DM stuff into your game, is that you publish that stuff, you put it in your book, and then DMs read it, and not knowing any better, they go, well, that's how I'm supposed to play. I'm supposed to be a huge, weird asshole who apparently doesn't have any concept of syntax.
Yeah, the problem is when the writer of the book
Weird asshole.
Yeah, well, it puts that into it. So you could have, say, the wish spell.
Yeah.
And it could go, it does these things, and have at the GM's discretion, a player can attempt to get something fun or creative outside of these rules. Now, if you stop right there, it doesn't encourage new DMs or people just reading it to go, oh, I'm supposed to fuck with people. But when you write down, you should fuck with someone if they do this, or the GM can punish a player for his temerity.
You know what? Every GM in the world thinks that they are a particularly crafty GM.
Oh yeah, nobody looks at that and goes, well, I'm not very crafty.
I'm so. By the book.
No, I do believe in the past I did actually read a published... I think it was even with the Wish spell. It ended with, you know, the sentence, and I quote, "The DM is encouraged to be fiendish." To that writer, fuck you.
Yeah. You are just encouraging bad GMing.
You're just saying don't take this spell, because once one player casts the spell once, and they get teleported to hell or something, and you're like, well, because you didn't present me a 33-page contract with a bunch of stipulations in it, I noticed one loophole in your two-sentence phrasing, and I have sent you to hell.
Also, have I noticed that I get off on being an asshole?
Yeah, it's not worth it. So, this book... It doesn't necessarily do that, but it does include the phrase "a particularly crafty or a particularly cruel GM" a bunch of times, because John Wick is that kind of author. I've read a few of his other things, and he likes that sort of thing. He likes to make sure the players know they're the fucking players.
And you know what? It's really unnecessary, because the truth is, you could play the rules right out of the book, will die horribly. This is not a game that, you know, looks at damage in an abstract fashion and says, it's cool, we can get into, you know, stab fights with Oni who wielding tree trunks and razor sharp blades, and it's alright because we'll just sleep it off over the weekend. If you take a bad hit, you lose your fucking arm.
Yep, this game is particularly fatal. There's a bunch of games like that that play the kind of, well, you know what happens when people get hit with swords in history? They fucking die.
They die.
You very rarely encounter anyone that has taken more than one sword hit.
Yeah,
and this game recognizes that, and
you can try, and, you know, if you're particularly hardy and your earth ring is high, you can be like, man, I can take, like, two sword hits and still be on my feet. That shit's insane.
Oh, yeah.
There's
even a special technique for Crab Clan Samurai at rank 2, where once a day you can try a fairly difficult earth roll, and if you succeed, you can just ignore a hit. You can just say, meh.
I shrug it off.
I don't even care.
And rub some dirt in it.
And every time I have ever seen that used, everyone on the table goes, damn, that's good. I wish I could do that.
That is real good. In a game like this where, this is just like an early Exalted where initiative and agility are king. And of course that means that you also have to be super smart, because in this game you can't have your agility be king unless you are also super smart, because that's your fire ring. This is one of those glass cannon games. Don't let anything hit you. But it's got a really interesting caveat to it, which is, don't let anything want to hit you. That's the big deal.
You're really best off not getting into a fight in the first place, and if you do get into a fight, everything in the setting, everything in the rules is really telling you, fight on your terms.
Yeah, don't get in that fight. There's a whole, one of the metafictions in here I really do enjoy, having dumped on them previously, there's one where two characters encounter each other, and ask to see each other's stances, and then they display their stances, and then one of them apologizes and leaves.
Oh yeah, they look at each other, they recognize one of them is better than the other, they don't have to actually have it out because they already know how it's gonna go and decide, you know what, that's cool, you win, I lose, we respect each other, let's not die today.
And I think one of the interesting things with damage in here is we already went over the roll X, keep Y, that applies to damage as well. So if you're using a weapon... and that weapon has only, say, a keep of 2, even if you're like, I'm a huge dude, and I've got this big weapon, and I hit you, and it's a great hit, I will only keep 2 dice of damage.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get into that exalted thing where it's like, okay, and I've got 40 dice of damage, and I just make this entire army shit itself in blood and explode.
That is a problem. Exalted in particular is a real problem with glass cannon design. Exalted, I hopefully they fix this in the third edition. They really need to get to the point where you can take a hit and not have to perfect out of everything and see who has more essence. That's just bad design. This game doesn't necessarily fall into that trap. It's really important not to get hit and not to get into fights, but getting into a fight isn't kind of a... well, okay, this fight's going to last 10 minutes, and then one of us will run out of essence, and the other one will win.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be a one-hit kill. You're even without a good Earth Ring. I mean, just a standard samurai is going to have a 2. You'll have enough hit boxes to, even with a, you know, decent weapon, you should be able to take a hit and not die.
One hit.
And this
then
game,
you should really be looking for an exit.
Right, this game has a strong culture of I've won just because I've won, and not I've won because I've taken your stuff.
Yeah, and it's, even then, even if you go to first hit, it's a game where because there's a cap on damage dice kept, you can do a duel to first blood, and that first blood isn't also last blood.
Right.
Like, you can basically assure that if you're doing a duel to first blood, the other guy will survive that hit.
So, let me ask Brian this question, because I didn't really... I read through the book, but it doesn't have a whole lot of stuff about the Shadowlands. Mm-hmm. One of the important things that the book imparts on you is, don't get in fights with other samurai unless you need to, because they are your equals, and you don't really need to spend your time beating on them, because they might kill you.
Yeah, that doesn't happen.
Does it give you chud enemies, like, in the Shadowlands? Are there like, rattlings and little baby demons? And
oh, yeah, there's goblins.
So you can get out there and because, you know, a lot of DMs have realized early on in their DM career that one of the best ways you can keep your players happy is to throw chuds at them. Just, here's useless bullshit. It might hit you, maybe, but mostly you get to kill them by the tens so you can describe it and feel awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you can do that. This, I think, really goes to one of the, at the same time, it's a strength and a weakness. It's a double-edged sword, I suppose. It's time for me to follow my sword. All right. Is the setting. Depending on the kind of game you want to run, more than most games, I would say, this game really, the storyteller needs to look at it, talk with his players, and say, okay, guys, what kind of a game are we playing here? Because that's really going to determine not just, you know, what kind of narratives you're going to be telling, what kind of stories, but also what kind of characters you want to create from minute one. If you want to play, you know, let's go out into the Shadowlands on a weekly excursion and kill goblins because that's our job, you really should say, all right, everybody, come up with characters that have an excuse to be south of the Cuden Wall. Because most characters, most samurai, never go there.
Right, so it's mostly, are you playing as people from various crab families, and maybe one guy who's disgraced enough that he has to spend all of his time over there?
Or some guy who's, like, trying to prove,
like,
earn his glory on the wall or whatever.
Maybe because, you know, he feels like he hasn't had the opportunity back home. I'm playing a unicorn samurai, and I'm trying to impress, you know, some girl back home so that I can get a good marriage for my family, but I can't get a decent assignment, I can't get a fair shake. I know what I'm gonna do. No one seems to give me, you know, any credit. I'm going to volunteer to go down to the wall, because they always need more manpower. Mm-hmm. I'm going to kill a whole bunch of goblins and Oni, and I'm going to come back having earned a bunch of glory and be somebody, and then actually do something for my clan.
Or more likely, you'll die.
You will die in disgrace, and no one will remember you.
Yeah. Well, one of the big things is, if you do die in the Shadowlands fighting Oni, at least people are like, well, he died trying to fight against the Shadow, so good for him. But if you die, like, I died in some duel with a guy who was obviously my better and goaded you into it.
You
know, everyone's like, what a fucking chode. Why did he do that?
Everybody tries to forget you. Your family's like, we don't talk about him.
This game has a really interesting concept to it of if you die, at least you die with enough glory that the person who was in charge of you will now also take care of your family. So if you're playing a particularly brutal game, you can just keep track of whose families are now great.
It goes further than that. There are places in the book where they actually provide advice to storytellers. Yeah, you know, if one of your characters, if one of your player's characters dies in a particularly good way, then, you know, take a look at their glory rating, and then their next character can actually, you know, come in and have some connection to them and have some mechanical benefits as a result. That's right. They wrote in a legacy system for not just if, but when your character dies.
Which is great. That's a great idea.
Very practical idea.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing that would make a lot of other games more playable. Old Dungeons & Dragons would really benefit from a system of oh god, I don't want my cleric to die under any circumstances ever. If it was, well, your cleric dies, and then your god gives his power to some other dude, plus some of his own power, and yay, you get to come back to the game, and it's gonna be fun.
You know, you're someone else in the church who's heard the stories of your other character, and he finds the mace that you used, and now it's been blessed with your power since you're dead, and so on.
So, one of the things we have with this book is we just have the core. We have the core book here. This is a game that had a lot of...
I could
of,
have given you some supplements.
He's got some great splat books for this. Splat books for this game added some stuff that are of controversial import. For example, it added Japanese, like, fox spirits and stuff. Like, you can play as Hengi Okai, and And
don't do that.
Kitsune, all those sorts of things that are basically just ways to combine your love of anime and being a furry.
Now, one of the things I will haven't talked about really in depth yet that I'd also like to bring up is the magic system in this.
Oh yeah, we haven't talked about it at all. Go for it.
So the Shugenja is the magic user guy. He is your mage,
mm-hmm.
and unlike, say, in, you know, your D&Ds and so on, if you're the magic guy, you don't just get spells that let you win.
No, you gotta have a scroll in your hand to cast that spell. Yeah.
Well, plus the role of the Shugenja isn't your standard, you know, Tolkien-esque wizard, I bellow an incantation and magic happens. The role really is more of a shaman. Magic in the system isn't some arcane force, it's negotiating with elemental spirits to do you favors.
Yeah. Spells when you cast a fireball, it's not you so. Just going, and magic happens, it's you ask fire spirits to lend you their power.
That's way more shaman-y, way more cleric-y than wizard-y. So basically that's where we're at. This is someone who communes with nature and the spirits and does so in an honorable and respectful fashion and gets, you know, a fireball. Gets a fireball. Usually it's kind of one of those worry words for me because I don't... Again, that comes down to the wish thing. I don't want to be like, well, my character uses his mechanic, nothing happens, haha, fire spirits hate you.
Usually in that most Shugenja are going to go by the prescribed rules, but there are some ways to bend it.
Yeah,
you,
absolutely.
You know, you could be a bully to the spirits, and that's sort of a bad idea.
In the long run.
You might get the short-term effects that you want, but in the long run, they might start getting a little surly. Also, because every Shugenja starts out with three core basic spells, Sense, Commune, and Summon, which are really just... They don't have set effects. Instead, they allow you to fulfill the role of talking to and acting as the bridge between the material world and the spirit world. These three tend to get overlooked, but a creative player can do a lot with them.
Absolutely.
And the spells themselves aren't really a lot... Like, there's not a lot of fireball-type spells. I mean, there is basically a fireball in there, but...
Fireball's in there, yeah. It's called Wrath of Amaterasu or something.
But it's one of those things where most of the spells are little effects, like, you know, you can have something like, you know, I create a ball of light, or...
Scrying through a pool of water.
You know, I can create some decent... like, ground for terrain, so we can get somewhere.
They're all very elementally,
the spells. And really, if you want to play a magic missile mage, L5R is not your game. That's just, you know, you can try, but it definitely feels forced. If you just want to beat the shit out of guys and see big damage numbers go up, do yourself a favor, play a Bushi. That's their job, is fighting. That's your profession. Shugenja... Their job is a little different. It can be really satisfying and very flexible and interesting, but you're not going to be running around hucking lightning bolts as a matter of course. You can do that, but it ain't your job.
And the amount of spells you can even cast is limited, with void rating, so it's not like you just sit there. Yeah, you're not just going to sit there hucking fireballs all day.
Spell scrolls in this game are as valuable as, like, honored swords. Mm-hmm. They're very rare. You only have a set number. You don't really get them. It's dishonorable to take them off the people you have recently killed, so it's difficult to get your hands on new ones. Yeah. There are ways.
It's not trivial to even just cast a spell, either. It's not just, I'm going to cast Lightning Bolt, and then you resolve the effect. It's, I want to try and cast a spell. All right, well, it's got a casting time that's not trivial, 3 rounds. Do you want to do that faster? Start burning raises.
Yeah.
And then you have to roll just to successfully cast the spell. It's an accomplishment just to get one off.
Which doesn't mean that they aren't balanced to Bushi. They did a pretty good job of keeping them balanced. I mean, I understand where you're probably thinking just listening to that is like, well, I remember when casting times existed in 2nd edition D&D, and it was... And if you actually played with that rule, it became real bad real fast, because it was like, well, my character starts casting Fireball. Goblin throws a rock at you at the end. This game actually has a pretty solid balancing mechanic between the two. Another thing I wanted to say about the Shugenja, they're not clerics either. There's very little in the way of
basically
natural healing.
Scholars in this game as well.
Yeah, there's not much in this game outside of natural healing that is healing. There's surgery. You can learn to be a surgeon. You shouldn't, because it's a low skill.
Well, yeah, you're handling dead flesh.
Dead flesh.
Good samurai do.
Yeah. So, but you can learn to be one. So that's the only kind of... And then there's some generic field dressing first aid type stuff that exists.
Yeah, and, you know, there are a couple spells of, like, this will increase your healing time, but it's, like,
it all
two of them.
It's all really reinforcing the original idea, which is don't get hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, really don't. Now, this is my first time reading L5R. I read it just a couple days ago, getting ready for this. But I was very experienced with the world of Rokugan, which is what this is set in. Again, that's basically a Japan the size of China. Because I own the third edition Oriental Adventures Dungeons & Dragons book.
Racist.
And it has, if for whatever reason, probably because at that point in history, Wizards of the Coast owned Legends of the Five Rings.
They acquired the license.
Yeah. So they produced an Oriental Adventures book, which had everything a normal Oriental Adventures book has, and then Rokugan stuff.
Which was such a bad idea.
It really highlights what makes Rokugan interesting. Because if you read through the Oriental Adventures 3rd Edition book, Rokugan stuff is like, well, okay, if you're playing in L5R, you can't have 8 out of 10 things in this book. Oh, well, that sounds awful.
Wow, all the fantasy races? No, they're not in here.
You can't have those. There's one. There's Rattlings. So they give you the Rattlings. But other than that, you can't play as the Korobokuru or the Hengyokai or the Venara or any of the other races that are in that book. You can't play as any of the classes that are in that book except for Samurai and Shugenja. And what it really does is highlight the difference in philosophy between the games. Dungeons & Dragons is a game that's defined by a wealth of options. Your character can be anything from anywhere. This game is defined by a dearth of options. It's defined by restrictions. How do you make yourself a distinctive character in a world where everyone is basically a samurai? Everyone has the same haircut.
Well, everyone who matters.
Everyone who matters is a samurai. Everyone has the same haircut. Everyone retires at the same age. How do you achieve distinction? And it's an interesting concept that it did not transfer all that well into Dungeons & Dragons.
We were actually having a discussion on the way over here today about the mechanics of a game and the aesthetics of the game going together. And when you try to divest the two, sometimes it can work, sometimes it can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you take something like L5R and you try to put it into D&D's mechanics.
It doesn't work.
It all falls apart.
Yeah. I'll tell you. In D&D, well, you know, one of the primary driving reasons why you play the game, hell, you show up every week going, I've got this longsword plus two. I want to try and get a longsword plus three. Maybe it'll be tonight. You know, you go into dungeons, you kill monsters, you come out with loot. Hooray! In L5R, you don't do that. You start, and you have your grandfather's sword, and if you give that up, why are you giving that up?
That's your grandfather's sword!
They try real hard to make that work in Dungeons & Dragons. A samurai is basically a fighter in D&D. Mm-hmm. The samurai class in 3rd edition Dungeons & Dragons has a feat every three levels instead of every two, like a fighter. And then at first level, what they get instead is an ancestral blade, and it has a plus one value equivalent to the level it should be.
And then they can start making ritual sacrifices at a shrine to try and increase the plus, level. Which is really just an obvious kludge to try and make the setting mesh with familiar mechanics when really the two were not meant for each other.
I don't know who wrote that book, but apparently they had never heard of multiclassing. Because one of the best ways to play a fighter in 3rd edition is to not. And then the second best way to play a fighter in 3rd edition is to play a samurai one, fighter the rest of the way.
Yep.
Because that way you go back to your regular every two levels feat progression, and plus you have an awesome magic sword that keeps getting better.
Yep.
Of course, you still shouldn't play them because they're still better than anyone who can cast a fucking spell.
Yeah.
The book was really fun. It actually has a really interesting set of prestige classes that are really neat, but every time you read through them, you're like, oh, that's awesome. I can't wait to play one of those. Don't use these in Rokugan settings. Like the eunuch mage who could, like, throw needles and have them turn into snakes in midair.
Nope. Sounds like a ninja.
Yeah, don't do that.
Which we haven't talked about, but yes, ninja do exist in the game.
Oh, God. Do they ever... They exist, and then every time they mention them in the book, they then go, but they probably don't exist. which is very clever in the terms of setting a story, like giving you a concept of of story.
It sets tone well. Nobody actually thinks ninja exist if you ask them in, you know, nice company.
You're at a tea party, and someone's like, I think I heard something about a ninja. Oh, ninjas! Oh!
Oh, no, of course not.
Right, but of course they actually exist, because it's not only is it a Japan the size of China, but it's a Japan that contains a lot of China. Because if it was just Japan, there wouldn't be any ninjas. That's not a Japanese thing.
Yeah, but everybody knows somebody that's been killed by a ninja.
Absolutely. Everyone knows one guy who got killed by some ninja sometime.
Oh, yeah. And it's always like, yeah, my brother fell off of his horse in a field and there was no one else around. We know it was a ninja.
It was ninjas.
Or scorpion trickery.
Well, yeah, that's the same thing.
Right. Well, no, it isn't. That's one of my favorite things about the
book. Yeah, it is.
Is that scorpions, they hire ninjas and they conspire with ninjas and they know some ninjas and maybe they know a guy who's a ninja. But they're not ninjas. They're not ninjas.
It's true.
They're samurai, and I like that about them, that they can also play this whole game of ninja. Well, now you're just being silly. So, you know, we're down into the last couple minutes of the game, so I want to go down the room and ask each person what their favorite and least favorite thing about the game is. I traditionally start with John, so I am going to do so. John, what is your favorite thing and your least favorite thing about this game?
I'm going to go with my favorite thing. I think I'm going to go with the keep system, almost specifically in damage, but I also do like it in the other aspects of it. When you get into a game, any game really, that has the multiple dice, not just say a d20, but even then where you have multiple additions onto your roll, it gets to a point where, especially in a binary system, you with a pass-fail, that it doesn't even matter anymore how many dice you have, or if you've got dice that are, you get X successes and it's just a shitload of damage, or way too good to hit that you can't get past it, then it becomes really hard as someone running the game to challenge you, and then you get into this sort of one-upsmanship with your players where you're trying to be better and they're trying to be better, and then eventually someone hits someone and they explode in gore.
Mm-hmm.
So with the keep system, even if you are rolling 50 million dice for damage,
it kind of gates that.
Yeah, you have this gating mechanic, and I like that.
Least favorite thing?
Least favorite thing? I'm gonna go with the, I don't like the magic system, I'll be honest. As much as it does end up being fairly balanced, the whole scroll thing and the limited way in which spells work, and there are a lot of spells that are like, you can raise 15 times, what does that do? Not a whole lot. I feel like the spells, I did look a little bit at some splat book spells, I feel like they started to realize they needed to do more later on, but just main book, that's all we're reviewing, I feel the spell system is a little lackluster.
Would you play this game?
I would totally play this game. Shit, I would even play this game as a Shugenja using the spell system I don't like. It's very interesting. It's got an interesting setting. But, yeah, I think it could use a later edition. I'd be interested
which
to see what the
new
edition. Of.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. John, I'm sorry. Brian, favorite thing about this game?
Oh, well, you know what? I'm going to say, I'm going to pick something that we didn't touch on, which is the mass combat system.
Oh, yeah.
We actually do have... It's a fairly brief little chapter in the game, but there's a neat little system here to handle big battles in Rokugan, because massive battles, clashes between armies and clans, is something that happens on a regular basis, and they did make an effort to try and handle the question of, when you've got player characters who are personally involved in a battle, how do you do that? And they offer a framework that is very successful, which is basically, they abstract the battles out into... round by round, usually a half dozen mass combat turns. And then each turn, you basically ask each of the players, what's your level of engagement in the battle? In other words, where do you want to be? Are you in the reserves? Are you fighting on the edges? Or does your character throw himself in where the fighting is thickest? And then there's a nice little chart. It's pretty straightforward. You make a roll, each character, depending on their battle skill, can kind of control more effectively how they're engaged in combat, and they get outcomes. So, like, if you're heavily engaged, but you're pretty good at it, you can throw yourself into the thick of battle. You know, you take an abstract number of wounds, which represents fatigue and little cuts and nicks, but you also gain glory, more of it, if you throw yourself in there and try to be a hero. You can earn opportunities to duel other heroes in the middle of the battle, or gain... heroic opportunities, like break the lines. I've used it before. To be honest, I have both played and run this game in the past. And I've actually pulled this little system out, modified it a little bit, and used it with completely different game systems to do similar things. And it's always been a success.
Least favorite thing about this game?
I don't think that the core rulebook really provides good support for storytellers who want to run the game and are like, okay, I've got players, everybody loves a different clan, I want an idea of how I can bring these people together. They're basically like, well, they could run Imperial Magistrates and I don't know.
All right.
It's not, there's not a whole lot of support there for helping people start up a good, successful campaign. It provides this really nice mechanical structure. The mechanics are robust. The setting is interesting. But if you are new to L5R and you're like, I want to run a game, they really don't give you much.
It kind of needs a DMG to go along with
yeah.
it.
Kinda, yeah. Would you play this game? I'm not sure why I'm asking.
I have and would, and you know what? Fuck it. If somebody told me, I'm going to run a first edition L5R game right now, would you want to play? I'd say, hell yeah.
All right.
Let's do it.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and say my favorite thing about this game is the combat mechanics. I think they did a really good job of getting across exactly how fighting occurred in that era, which was basically, if you got hit with a katana, it impacted your head and you're dead now. And that's how that worked. I like that. I like that they got that right and still managed to come up with a game that doesn't feel like a joke. Like, it doesn't feel like, well, put your character into the game, they're dead. Put your next character into the game, they're also dead.
It's not paranoia.
So that's nice. I feel like they did a great job there. My least favorite thing about this game, I've already brought up, and it's the kind of broad stereotyping that exists in it. There's 10... I would want to say that clans in this game are basically your race. They're the closest thing in this game to your race. Like, yeah. A lion is very different from a crab, is very different from a unicorn. And to me, they're a little overly stereotyped. I know you can play outside that box and play it right, but the book makes it like, well, if you're a lion, then you're a brash, barbarian outsider. Do that, or you're useless. I'm not a big fan of that kind of thing. I feel the same way when I'm playing games that have a race, and it's like, well, elves live in the forest and appreciate sculpture, and if you play a city elf, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, they set tone really hard in the core book, and once you can get past that, it gets a lot better, but they do sell it hard.
They really do.
They do a decent job with the different families to go... Some families are a little less stereotypical than the others.
Yeah,
but
those are like sub-races in this game. That's like, if you're a wild elf, then maybe you're Matsu. Maybe you're a lion of the Matsu family. God, I hope lion and Matsu are correct.
They are.
Yay! I got one!
You got so many other things wrong, but that one was good.
Yay! Okay, and then would I play this game? Sure. I'm the one person here who was not. And I would give this game a try. It seems like a lot of fun. I went into it with some serious reservations. I'm not a huge fan. I tend to have a kind of opinion of gamers, and one of the opinions of gamers I run into is that you'll occasionally encounter about 1 in 10 who is obsessed with Glorious Nippon, and they want to talk to you about Folded Steel and Katana and how great they are, and they really want to drag that shit into your D&D game. I generally don't care for that sort of thing. Even though I love watching me some anime and I love reading about Japanese history, I really hate nerds who are into those things.
Huh.
Specifically into those things. Mm. So, but this game has won me over. I would play it. It's well designed, and it does a good job of respectfully treating that setting without making it about how superior it is.
Yeah, they did at least do a good job of being like, here's, you know, fantasy Japan, but it's not fanboying out about Japan.
Yeah. There's some stuff in there about like Japanese traditional life at that point, about how like marriage was all arrangements and how there were comfort girls and how geisha operated. Of course, the books, I've seen some of the splat books, and the geisha art is always sexy chicks in kimonos that are unreasonably tight. But I would have really liked to see them go straight up, what does a 15th century geisha look like? Oh, well, they kind of look like a rectangle with blacked out teeth.
There are some pictures like that elsewhere, so, you know, they're pretty legit. That,
but you have to understand that artists for any RPG are going to be like, how sexy can I make this lady?
Can I put boobs on this?
Oh, yeah. No, especially, I think, in the later editions, they felt the need to sexy it up for sales, but...
Absolutely. We didn't really get to touch on John Wick all that much. John Wick famously is an adversarial DM of a writer. He really likes to write characters that have all the secrets and get to fuck over players. But, you know, the reason we didn't really get to talk about that is because I guess he didn't get started until after first edition L5R core book. Because every time you go on the internet, just Google that guy and you get all this stuff about how he's a goddamn fucking monster that really wants your players to hate fun and not like you and not send you Christmas cards.
I actually met John Wick, and he was a nice guy when I talked to him.
I've met Kevin Symbieta, and he was a nice guy, but damn, he can't write a book.
Oh, I'm sure Wick is a terrible GM, but...
Yeah. Yeah, well, anyway, we didn't get into that because for this book, at least, he's a good guy. He might maybe grew up into the Grinch, but
no,
he started
sure
out...
You see the seeds of that with the a clever GM will, and then it bloomed into the oak tree of
this choice is a double-edged sword. I'm pretty sure by the time you get to the 5th and 6th Blatt books for the 3rd edition of this, you find a bunch of stuff where, like, well, this choice could be taken by a player, but it's a quintuple-edged sword.
Well, there's a whole section that we didn't touch on in the back that's, like, major NPCs, and they're basically all people who are more important than you ever will be.
Oh, yeah, and a lot of them break the rules for, like, there's a lot of famous NPCs from this game. They're like clearly had stats of 5 at the start, and it's because they're people of note and they need be important.
They've
but
got special rules, yeah. special
dispensation.
But players hate special specialness. They don't want to know that Elminster started with an 18 and everything. They hate him now because it's like, well, fuck you. How come you didn't have to follow these same bullshit rules? I don't want to.
So, honestly, the best way to handle that section, and for that matter, all of the specialness NPCs in this entire setting...
Ignore them.
Yeah, yeah. They're all operating at the highest levels of the clans, you'll never talk with them, and really, that's fine.
Hey, you don't need to deal with them. Wick likes to put them in there because he thinks it may be fun to have them. You know what? DMPCs, in general, are just a terrible idea. If you have a guy who shows up with your party and he's like, hey guys, I know how to get through this dungeon. I will walk you through. Also, my sword does more damage than yours. You know, like, oh, don't put that character in there. Why did you do that?
Yeah.
And honestly, in this setting, it's not too hard to avoid that because you can just look at them and go, yeah, he's the champion of the clan. Yeah, he's way cooler than, more awesome than you ever will be. You know what he's doing? Pushing pencils.
Champion stuff. He's not you.
No, he's running the clan.
Yeah.
He doesn't even get to go outside most of the time.
Okay, so... we've hit about an hour plus. This is an interesting game. We've talked about it a little longer than normal. We all agree we'd play this one. We all agree we have stuff we really like about it. I'm going to go ahead and give this one a solid recommend. You can play this game and not have a terrible time. Tune in a couple of weeks. We're going to try and review Cinnabar.
Oh.
I'm sorry, John.
Why do you hate me?
Don't worry. At least Brian gets to dodge Cinnabar. I'll loan it to you if you want to read it.
Good luck, guys.
Yeah. Cinnabar is basically riffs except written by a slightly smugger person. He's the kind of guy who owns more than one short sword.
Oh, no.
That kind of guy. Raven C.S. McCracken is the famous author of Cinnabar, which is, again, it's a sci-fi post-apocalypse set on a Dyson sphere because he had just heard of those. You can play as a raccoon with a bazooka. It's going to be a real good one. We're going to get right back into the hate that you guys crave. So this is System Mastery. You can find us at systemmastery@gmail.com, systemmasterypodcast.com. We are System Mastery on Twitter as well. So from all of us at System Mastery, thank you very much, and we will see you in a couple of weeks.